Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Dwayne, Tosin, how you guys doing?
Hey, I'm all right. All right, yeah.
Enjoying the weather here in California.
What are you guys doing on September 10th?
Don't think I have anything planned.
Well, let me check the calendar here. Nothing big.
Nothing big?
Yeah. What are you doing?
I'm probably going to be standing in line somewhere, I think, or maybe tuning in to the internet.
What's going on?
Well, it's Apple's big iPhone event. Apple's going to be announcing the latest iPhone, which is probably going to be called the iPhone S.
What? Oh, this is great. We should talk about this.
We if only we had a podcast to talk about this on. We are going to talk about this. We're going to talk about this here tonight on the Drill Down. Hello and welcome to the Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
I'm Dosin Anafawakin.
This week, no silver lining for cloud services in the wake of NSA leaks, BlackBerry looks for a buyer, Bitcoin gets subpoenaed, Tesla's Elon Musk wants us all to be in the loop, and more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes by going to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes subscription link is in the right-hand sidebar. And, of course, subscribe to us on facebook.com/thedrilldown and twitter.com/thedrilldown. And our show's also on Stitcher, so go to stitcher.com and look for The Drill Down there. How you guys doing? Yes, we're everywhere.
I'm all right. You know, I'm excited. This Apple news is cool stuff. I think there's been a lot of pressure on the company to drop some interesting things. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk going on.
So the iPhone 5, the new one, we're assuming it's going to be an S because that's the typical, you know, you're the nomenclature guy, Dwayne. You're the guy who gets hung up on what the version of the iPhone is.
Hey, I was the first one to say that the third iPad wasn't going to be called the iPad HD.
right. Well, you called that for sure.
And I gotta say, if we are indeed looking at a world where there's a less expensively produced iPhone, one that has, you know, goes back to the plastic and is designed for developing nations, as we've heard, then I think we're looking at possibly an iPhone that is not numbered anymore, an iPhone S, an iPhone, you know, something else.
They're talking about possibly two different models coming out, like the iPhone 5S, which is going to be that stopgap version that they usually put out between the whole
major
version,
releases,
the major releases release. Between major releases, the stopgap version, and the low cost compact one that you're talking about, which rumors is saying they're going to call the C, the 5C,
the 5C, the 5 cheap. I gotta say I don't disagree with you, but I do think that this situation with the S series, I don't know if that's the stopgap version. I tend to find that the stopgap version, it tends to be the version that they got right. The iPhone 4 had antenna gate. The iPhone 4S solved all those issues. The iPhone 3G was basically an iPhone wrapped up with some new antenna, and the iPhone 3GS was where they weren't focused on the outer design. They were focused on making the thing work really well. So I'm a big fan of the S series, and I think of it as the revision, not less though, so than the stopgap.
So what did the 5 get wrong that the 5S is going to revise?
I think the 5 got wrong. I don't like the antenna on the 5. I will be sitting with my girlfriend and her 4S, or my friends and their 4. I have a couple of photos. We take them. And my 5 will be on edge while the rest of them are enjoying 3G or 4G. And this is with or without me enabling LTE. I think the 5's battery has a little bit to be desired. I'm not going to say that it's the worst battery ever, but I definitely feel as if, as a guy who uses his phone, you know, not so much during the workday, I really do wish there was a bit more juice in that puppy. And I think that the build quality of the 5 is reasonable, but could be better.
So do you actually think that Apple can get away with just making it work work better, like iterating a bit on the 5? Or do you think that we're really expecting and needing something that is...
I think under the hood changes are what happens on this in this revision, the S revision, if we're thinking about S cycle versus normal cycle. So the stuff we've been hearing about capacitive fingerprint technology,
right.
That's exciting because that's a real feature that is hardware-based that's in there that they can think about putting together because they're not worried about the design of the phone specifically. There's also stuff like, what is that enabled? If I can use my finger to prove that I'm me and I'm not just somebody who stole my password, then suddenly NFC gets put back in the game or technologies like it. So that's where I get excited about the S series. It's what haven't we thought of? What more can we shove under the hood? And that's exciting for a tech geek.
All right. Well, we will find out for sure when it's September 10th rolls around and Apple announces everything that it's going to announce, including we've also heard rumors of new iPads as well, new particularly Retina display iPad mini.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds expensive. I wonder if they'll be able to keep the same price point. I mean, they have in the past when the new iPad with Retina display came out in 2011, they were able to basically, or 2012, they were able to basically keep the pricing the same, and they kept the iPad 2 around. The iPad 2 is still around as a non-Retina device. So that's interesting.
So moving on, BlackBerry this week halted trading in its shares to announce it's exploring strategic alternatives, including a possible sale or other partnership. Its shares have fallen 38% in the last 6 months. This kind of breaks my heart a little because BlackBerry's... Well, you know, the thing is that we've seen BlackBerry go through this. It's kind of like when, you know, not to be glib about it, but it's kind of like when you know somebody with cancer and they've it's a long, protracted, you know, illness that you see them withering in degrees.
No, it's not like that. You know what it is? It's like when you know somebody who's smoking, who eats a lot of sugar and a lot of fat, and you're like, dude, you need to get more healthy. And they're like, nah, man, I got this. I got two CEOs. I got two ringdings in my mouth.
Right.
I got this, right? And then suddenly they're like, oh, I'm sick. I might have to go, you know, I might have to get triple bypass surgery. I might have to lose a leg. I might go blind because this diabetes caught up to me.
They're like, we got enterprise, bitch. We don't need... You know,
right? We don't need to
we
be
don't
healthy.
Need consumers.
You know, I work out a lot, so I don't need to eat right. You know, that's what I feel like I'm seeing.
Yeah.
With what's going on with BlackBerry, this isn't like, oh man, he lives such a good life, and now you know he's elder and he's going that route. No, it's not like that at all. It's like everybody and their mother said, get with the program, and they were like, nah, man, keyboards on your phone.
Keyboards. There's a terrific article basically about the things that caused BlackBerry to fall. And the crux of it is basically the fact that they thought that they had enterprise. They thought that there was this sort of delineation where people would expect to use BlackBerry at work and then iPhones at home. But what they didn't count on is that people were in love with their iPhones and wanted to use them at work also. And then companies started allowing that to happen and it slowly edged BlackBerry out of the market. And by the time...
No, what they forgot was just straight up innovation. If someone comes around, I mean, when they stepped into the consumer market in late 2006 and 2007, 2008 with the BlackBerry Curve, there was a BlackBerry that regular people wanted. They didn't go through contracts with their companies. They went through just the providers like T-Mobile and Verizon and so on. And they made the BlackBerry Pearl. Again, a phone designed to jump into the consumer market. So this weird myopia that they went through where they suddenly couldn't see in front of their face that there was a consumer-based smartphone that had a lot of applications, powerful hardware, an app ecosystem to rule them all. And they were like, nah, we got enterprise. That is nuts because they were in the consumer space, and instead of just seeding the consumer space, they should have been like, man, we really got to innovate. We really have to at least try to catch up so that this doesn't eat, this doesn't do the opposite of what we thought we were doing. This doesn't jump in to our business space the way we were jumping from the business space into the consumer space with the curve and the pearl. We have to make sure that we don't become obsolete the way that we had intended to make so many feature phones like the Danger obsolete with our BlackBerry Pearl. But they did not do that. They sat by idly and tried to maintain contracts the way a government contractor, defense contractor would with like the Navy or something like that. They sat by and they said, oh, we got this. We're so secure. Oh, we got this. We're so whatever. Without even thinking that anyone could truly catch up to them, which is as foolhardy as it is ignorant. And then they had the two CEOs, one for software, one for hardware, right, which is just bad business. Never heard of two executives. You think we can have two presidents? This isn't Rome. We don't have two consoles, right? This is not, that's not how business is done in North America. And I get that they were trying to maybe innovate on the business side, but the fact is they had factions in their situation that weren't rolled up, and they tried to appease all of them, and that's why they are where they are. Strong leadership, good management, and a vision for the future instead of relying on contracts that you already have that, frankly, only exist for, you know, less than a half a decade at a time. So, I see, again, BlackBerry is the friend or the family member that,
right, that everyone told, said,
everyone said, yeah, hey man, you're on the wrong path, and they said, nah, we got this. Nah, this heroin thing, I got it.
We
it's
did
mine.
An intervention with BlackBerry. We all sat around the living room and gave them, you know, what's what. Is there any hope for BlackBerry, or is this really truly the beginning of the end?
They have a powerful patent portfolio. They have some users that are still interested in their product, but I really think it's a question of breaking up the company and determining which pieces can go the farthest and
like,
working. And work
BlackBerry messaging, I feel, is probably one of those strongest pieces.
I'm looking at a Sega-like situation, mm-hmm, where Sega now makes games. They got out of the hardware business. And Atari-like situation where Atari just makes the games that got out of the hardware business.
Like a BBM app for the iPhone?
Maybe like a BBM app, or maybe just, you know, powering apps, or they could sell the hardware part. Because they have manufacturing facilities here, there, and everywhere that know how to make some reasonable hardware in the BlackBerry 10 devices, and basically take some of their underlying technology, that RIM technology that allowed for the emulation of Android. There's a use for that somewhere. That they'll have some cash from selling. There's several apps, especially business apps, that they can buy and use their relationships, their Rolodex, to improve upon and get insight into. So they can look at things like Clear, like Cal, and say, hey, this is totally something that we could purchase and then innovate upon.
All right. Well, let's move on here. Almost a year ago, Elon Musk, CEO of Tesla and SpaceX, first floated the idea of a super fast mode of transportation. And this week, he finally revealed the details. A solar-powered city-to-city elevated transit system that could take passengers and cars from L.A. to San Francisco in 30 minutes. He calls it the Hyperloop, and in his vision, it would transport people via aluminum pods enclosed inside of steel tubes, using mostly air to push the tubes, these pods.
It's
through
vacuum
the tubes,
man. It's like, yeah, the internet. Internet's made of tubes. He's just trying to make people in them.
And this guy can finally say he was right about clogging tubes.
Exactly.
Passed away. Exactly.
He passed away, right? Yeah,
he did. We're bringing Futurama here, and
exactly. That's really funny.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, I think it's an outstanding idea, and I think I feel like one of the really driving factors for Musk is just trying to make his life and everyday life easier. You know, from what we've seen with electric cars and, you know, other things that are transportation heavy, and you can see that especially even coming from California. There's been an ongoing project for a lengthy period of time to try and get, you know, fast train from I believe it's San Francisco to LA, and that's just been caught in so many
farmers don't like it, this doesn't like it, the car industry hates it. It's in development hell.
And Musk just goes out and says, here, this is an idea that has been fully fleshed out by myself as well as top members from my organization. Have at it, world.
Well, it's also like, you know, we were just talking about BlackBerry and their lack of innovation, their complacency. Musk is not afraid to say something that is seems radical on its face because he believes that his leadership and his logistics ability and his vision can really make something like it, make it happen. You know, like make it happen or something like it happen. The fact is, people love the idea of a powerful electric vehicle. People love the idea of conquering space and doing it through an Iron Man privateer like Musk. So the idea that he can figure out...
He's not actually investing in this himself.
I know, but his vision...
Sure.
You know, it's sort of like Donald Trump was a pioneering real estate mogul, and then he had a vision, and he's like, hey, I'm going to get behind this thing and that thing and that thing, and that all worked out. There are buildings with Trump's name on it that Trump never touched. But he's got a brand now. He's got a brand of being a visionary, of being a future guy, of being like, hey, where are we going next? And I think that that's what he's lending himself to in terms of, hey, I think that people should get behind this idea. I'm too focused on what I'm doing to be a legitimate, you know, a serious part of it. That's real. It's real for a guy to be able to say, you know what, I'm not going to put everything I have behind this. But this is worth investigating. Because this can change people's lives in a material way with technology that we already have or can easily develop. Or maybe not easily, but, you know, develop. And I think that's powerful. And it's one of those things we need to explore. I also think it's kind of interesting that, like, to get an idea for people listening, you've been to Costco when they put the money in that vacuum tube to get sucked up. That's pretty much what he's suggesting for people. But frankly, if you can get 10 or 12 of those tubes, you know, set up, and you can have a reasonable computer figuring out what's where, you can have a pretty astounding system. And you can also open up new housing markets in between San Francisco and L.A. that wouldn't have been there before. I mean, there's a lot of economic mojo going on with an idea like this.
Yeah, it's interesting. On the Musk's SpaceX site, he's got the PDF proposal of the whole Hyperloop, the entire proposal is there, broken off into two sections, like a sort of simple layman explanation, and then he gets into a really sort of technical explanation with diagrams and charts and all that on there. So it's worth checking out.
I'd love to see that kind of thing, you know, getting people to airports in states that have, you know, maybe that are relatively flat and have, you know, a big city like Nebraska has a couple big cities, but it's relatively flat and they have a big airport one place and it's hours away from another place. Like, yeah, start the commerce that way. Make it so that people can live in places that are relatively far away, but are accessible. You know, that's really cool.
Yeah. I would love to go to, you know, from LA to San Francisco in 30 minutes. I think that would be awesome.
Yeah. Smoother ride too. Yeah. I mean, that's another really cool.
Currently the only way to do that really, not even in 30 minutes, but the quickest way to do that is by air travel. And this would completely eliminate a lot of the, I mean, there are a lot of major expenses involved with air travel, and the least of which is the jet fuel itself. And this would eliminate all of those expenses. It's being proposed at 1/10 of the cost of a similar train system, like a standard train system.
Yeah, guys, this is the kind of thing where if you're United, if you're you know, JetBlue, this is where you want to put some of your investment capital in, right?
Yeah.
Because you want to hedge. You have to think of yourself as more than an airline and as a transportation company, and you want to hedge and say, if this takes off, I'm not going to be left out in the cold for my regional air transportation, right?
Right.
I'm just saying.
All right, let's move on here to our last headline before we get into our hot topic here. So this weekend, you pointed this out to me, Dwayne, that John Carmack, the legendary programmer behind id Software and creator of Doom and Quake, has joined the Oculus team as their new CTO. Now, Oculus is, of course, the team that's developing the Rift, which is the low-cost, high-quality VR headset that was launched on Kickstarter, and it's garnering rave reviews from anyone lucky to try it out. I have not yet tried out the Rift myself, but I've actually watched people doing it and watched them sort of freak out about it in a good way. Carmack has been one of the top evangelists for the hardware since it started, and he says, now is a special time. I believe that VR will have a huge impact in the coming years, but everyone working today is a pioneer. The paradigms that everyone will take for granted in the future are being figured out today, probably by people reading this message.
Yeah. I mean, John Carmack, for those who don't know, is a gaming... I will use the word pioneer. I would also say he's a Prometheus when it comes to gaming. He introduced Wolfenstein 3D. He introduced he was behind Quake, many of the iterations. He is the guy behind ID Software, which made 3D gaming one of those things that took over in the late 90s. Wolfenstein 3D came out in 1993, and it was running on a 133 processor or less, and it was a powerful way to be immersed in a 3D reality, and you got to kill Nazi monsters. So that was really cool too. But the bottom line is that this guy's been around for quite some time.
Yep.
He is the grandfather of first-person shooters, and he is looking for the next, you know, paradigm in gaming, the next game experience. And that says a lot to me. When you read books like Ready Player One, John Carmack is who... is the developer that they're saying, you know, that they're emulating when they talk about the guys who are behind this awesome technology. This guy has reimagined worlds. He got to a point where he wasn't even making the games anymore. Yeah. He was making the technology to allow the other people's games do really well. You think about that first Counter-Strike. That's on a Quake engine. You know what I mean? So, I mean, this guy is he is the bee's knees. He's gold when it comes to understanding what's next.
Really, if you want to sort of... If you want to sort of boil it down, John Carmack had the vision for immersive gameplay. He had the original vision for immersive gameplay that led to the creation of games like Doom and Wolfenstein 3D. And I think
Bond, when you're playing Bond, that's his paradigm. That first-person shooter paradigm, that Halo paradigm, that's him. He's the guy who made that happen first.
And I think it says a lot that he is... not only evangelizing the software, but is, you know, actively part of its creation now.
Exactly. And another thing is that because he's been part of all these things, so ID Software, the guys who made Quake and Wolfenstein and Doom and all these things, they were never a humongous company. They never became a Blizzard. They never became an EA Sports. Right. But they would make these things... and they would do them at relatively small, you know, relatively small amounts of people, you know, maybe 30 people, maybe less. So he's rich.
Yes. Yes.
He's rich.
He doesn't need the money for the CTO role.
So he's not looking for a job. He's looking for being part of the next big thing, I think is what me and Andy are saying. So
kind of like Elon Musk, who we were just talking about.
Yeah, Elon Musk, I mean, he was out of PayPal. He was one of the founders of PayPal. He made a ton of money from the sale of PayPal to eBay. And he could have just stopped, but he has vision. And it's people like him that I think drill downers look up to.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'd like to recommend today is called The Introvert Advantage, How to Thrive in an Extrovert World by Marty Olson Laney, PhD. The Introvert Advantage dispels common myths about introverts. They're not necessarily shy, aloof, or antisocial, and explains how they're hardwired from birth to focus inward. So outside stimulations such as chit-chat, phone calls, parties, and office meetings can easily become too much. It provides tools to improve relationships with partners, kids, colleagues, and friends while offering dozens of tips. In short, The Introvert Advantage shows introverts how to take advantage of their special qualities, not only to survive in an extrovert-oriented world, but to thrive. Do either of you guys consider yourself introverts?
Probably not.
I don't know how I define myself.
Like, if I said I were introvert,
yeah,
that'd be like a bald-faced lie. right? Like,
I don't know. Sometimes,
like, I'd have to go to confession and be like, "Hey, priest, I lied and said I was an introvert." Like, I grew up wishing I was an introvert. Just like keep my goddamn mouth shut. But you know, it's get beat up so much. But whatever.
I think I consider myself an introvert. I think that's that piques my interest about this book so much, is that, you know, I'm only an extrovert when it comes to something that I'm really interested in, like talking about tech is something that fascinates me, so I can talk on and on about it. But for the most part, I generally tend to keep to myself. I don't like small talk. I don't mingle a lot. So something like this is this book is interesting to me, because it maybe will teach me how to use my what I consider shortcomings to my advantage.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like I definitely get excited about talking about tech too, which is why I think we're all here. I definitely don't like, you know, there's a lot of bullshit in the world, and who wants to talk about that? Yeah. Who wants to think about that? So if it's all about, if it's about looking in and helping do that, there's something cool about that, because it actually like leads toward that sort of, you think about Buddhists and that and or like people who meditate in that idea, and I think that there's probably a lot of room there for an introvert to get some expression.
Hadn't thought about that. In any case, to download that free audiobook or any one of other of Audible's 100,000 plus titles, all you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel it and you still get to keep the Introvert Advantage or any book that you had chosen as your free audiobook. If you go to that site, audibletrial.com/thedrilldown, it helps our site out. So please do that. All right, we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, will the NSA surveillance leak change cloud computing and cybersecurity forever? Take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Onufuwakin. The fallout from the revelations leaked by the NSA contractor Edward Snowden continues. Two email providers have shuttered their services, citing U.S. law enforcement agencies' practice of demanding access to users' data. Last Thursday, LavaBit, an email provider used directly by Edward Snowden and made popular because of its privacy standards, announced that it was immediately ending its service. LavaBit CEO Ladar Levison said, "This experience has taught me one very important lesson. Without congressional action or a strong judicial precedent, I would strongly recommend against anyone trusting their private data to a company with physical ties to the United States." Ouch. On Friday, another service, Silent Circle, made the same decision. John Callis, the company's CTO, said Silent Circle saw the writing on the wall in the wake of LavaBit's decision. So
what about these two companies made them shut their doors? Could you lay that out for us?
Well, you know, the CEO of LavaBit, Ladar Levinson, actually spoke with Democracy Now!, and he said, there's information that I can't even share with my lawyer, let alone with the American public. So if we're talking about secrecy, you know, it's really been taken to the extreme, and I think it's really being used by the current administration to cover up tactics that they may be ashamed of. So the thing is there's
Or not just ashamed of, they might not be ashamed of it, but they may not be at liberty to discuss those tactics in order to maintain whatever advantage they think they have over terrorists or the people that they're trying to track.
Yeah, but they also have a gag order out to these companies involved that they can't talk about it either. So I think rather than in the case of Silent Circle and Lavabit, rather than break that gag order, they've decided to commit essentially, you know, corporate seppuku and bow out of the business entirely, like take themselves out of the game. I kind of have to admire that strategy, even though it's, you know, nuclear
option.
If you've
got money in the bank, why run it down as your customer base leaves because you can no longer provide them with a viable service?
Right.
Right?
Right.
Like, if you've got money in the bank, okay, we shutter it down, we take what funds we have, and we see where that leaves us. But we pay off all our debts and, you know, because the other thing is, like, going into bankruptcy and having a long, drawn-out death, right?
Yeah. But what does this mean for other companies like this? Any company, any sort of cloud service that has involvements with the NSA, which, as we've seen, is all of them. The NSA, not by their choice either. The NSA wants all the information they can siphon from all of these companies. What does that say to the customers of these companies? Like, where...
The government is always looking at what you do.
Yeah.
You need to watch what you do, or you need to find a way that's not popular to get across what you do privately.
And if you're someone who lives in another country and you're looking to start an account with one of these American companies, I mean, immediately you have to take a second thought and think, it boils down to, do I want to trust an American company with my data?
There's no doubt this is terrible for business. Business is saying, hey, we've made some of the best products in the world. We've innovated in order to keep these products secure and safe, and our government is sabotaging that effort with these watch programs and these policies. We can do nothing about it. That leaves the door open for others to hop in there. People in France, maybe, you know, technology companies in England, and say, hey, we're going to do what these guys used to do because our government isn't honest like that. Or maybe their governments are, but they have things that are in place to protect them. I mean, let's be clear. The United States is not the only country in the Western world, in the Western civilization that is dealing with these issues. It's just that in other countries, this is not something that people worry about as much, because the level of freedom that we're used to is not available in so many countries that are our allies,
right,
that are in the West, right, you know, that kind of thing. So the big, big issue here is that the freedom that we're used to is coming across as being infringed upon. And it's not something that everybody else is really that upset about all the time, you know? So if you're a French guy and you're like, oh, the U.S. government's looking at my stuff, you may not be crazy worried about it, because you're like, well, I don't care about the government looking at my stuff. I'm a French guy. We're socialist. The government looks at everything. Whatever. Or you may be like, wow, that's really fucked up and I need to go and start my own thing. Regardless, it brings a level of uncertainty to American cloud businesses.
Yes.
And that level of uncertainty does not allow them to maintain stability, to think about where they want to invest their resources in the future. And that's not a good thing for business ever.
There was a study done by the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation. They did a survey of 500.
I love how that exists, by the way.
Yeah. I think they're relatively recent. They're like a 3-year-old organization. But they did a survey of 500 respondents, and they asked them. They basically said that 56% of non-U.S. residents were less likely to use U.S.-based cloud providers in light of the recent revelations about the NSA. And on top of that, another 36% of U.S. residents said that the NSA leaks have made it more difficult for them to quote, do business outside of the United States. And the this organization, the Information Technology and Innovation Foundation, they've estimated that this is going to cut as much as $35 billion off the top lines of U.S. cloud computing companies over the next 3 years.
It's going to cut dollars. It's going to cut jobs. Companies are going to move overseas. If you're the company with a real mission, you might think about moving overseas and serving Americans in a limited capacity, but seeking the legal refuge of another Western nation instead of dealing with the American NSA rules. You know what I mean? So, like, if you can get yourself to a place like, I don't know, I don't know which companies have super secret rules or don't, but if you can get yourself to a Western power that has lots of respect for privacy and isn't going to go and jump in and shit like that, and you can serve Americans, you're like, hey, I'm going to go do that and move my shit overseas because that's where you can get that level of power. This is a huge, like smack in the face of the most one of the fastest growing industries in our country, cloud-based services. This is where our growth is coming from. Yeah. So it's kind of a shame that this is being attacked.
Any thoughts on this, Tosin?
Working in a cloud-based company yourself?
I mean, I would say, you know, of course there are always the of course when you're dealing with international countries and nations, there are lots of concerns to be had. I will say, you know, in general, it's I think being in the technological sphere, we do have a lot of concerns with these sort of stories, but I also kind of feel to a certain extent people are sort of accepting and have been accepting of these sort of cases before, and that's, you know, maybe that will change as more and more people start really paying attention to it in general. But it just seems, at least that's my inkling for those who aren't, you know, technophiles, I guess, so to speak.
You know what I find a little ironic about all this is that according to the New York Times, the NSA has been lobbying inside the government to deploy the equivalent of a Star Wars defense for America's computer networks, designed to intercept cyber attacks before they could cripple power plants, banks, or financial markets. And apparently, that plan now has virtually no chance of moving forward, given the backlash against the NSA over the recent disclosures about surveillance. So now it's a direct effect. These leaks have had a direct effect theoretically on our national security, our infrastructures.
If you work for the NSA right now, how do you feel? Are you the kind of, I mean, is it the kind of thing where the vast majority of NSA people are like, whatever, we've known all this shit, whatever. Are people saying, okay, it's time for me to leave? Because there are plenty of people in the NSA who are not exposed. You know, the NSA is a secret. It's a organization that's dealing with security. So a lot of people who don't get exposed to everything within it. So are you going to sit there and say, I need to not work for the NSA anymore? Like, I wonder the psychology of NSA workers right now as they realize, hey, look, we're trying to save you guys from getting attacked. You know, at the same time, some of them were ignorant to what's happening on the Freedom Front, and I think it's definitely got to be a struggle for them. It's just one thing to keep in mind. And yeah, I mean, if you're working on projects like Star Wars for computer systems, then suddenly you realize you're SOL because you're blocked by forces out of your control to move things forward. And if that's what you've been working on, and that's like kind of what your career metrics are based, then you're in trouble for like advancing. That's a shame.
Yeah, I will say I do feel like this article is, or at least the previous article regarding costing $35 billion, I think to an extent that's
somewhat of an exaggeration.
I think it is an exaggeration, but I also think it's not completely truthful, right? Say it's $35 billion, what's the actual market size? Market size is tremendous, I would say, since everyone is moving in that direction. Yeah. So. I think it's a headline grabber.
yeah, even if it's not, even if it's not an exaggeration in terms of how many billion it is, the fact is, what's the percentage of the actual market this is going to affect? If Silicon Valley and cloud situations are bringing in multiple billions of product, multiple billions of dollars, this may be, you know, insignificant. That said, $35 billion, if it is the proper number, is rarely an insignificant number.
The NSA is intending to fire 90% of their sysadmins to in the hopes to eliminate future leaks. That's going to be an interesting move for them to make.
I hope nobody in the NSA needs support for some time.
Yeah.
What's to say this is primarily the NSA canceling the contract they with Snowden's company? I bet you a good chunk of that is that.
Booz Allen is going to be all right. I don't think Booz Allen's going to run out of anything. I think that they might have to pivot in terms of the services they provide, but Booz Allen will probably be able to be okay here. The letting go of contractors is the same as cutting jobs when it comes to the way politics looks at job creation. You look at the sequester, and it's contractors that get hurt. Lockheed Martin here in Boulder, jobs are getting lost left, right, and center, and people are having to decide whether they want to move to other Lockheed offices around the country or whether they're going to look for another job altogether, because that's kind of how the government works. Many of people who work, quote unquote, for the government are working in private service because in many ways it's cheaper.
Yeah, I will say it's well, A, kind of sucks if you're one of like Snowden's
co-workers.
Co-workers, right? Because you're just like, wow, you've just cost you a job.
Right.
Right. And it's on one hand, I definitely do think that Booz Allen will turn just fine, because if you actually look at, you know, Snowden's history, he also worked for the CIA, among other organizations. And so there was a lot of trust coming from, you know, where he got all his clearance for. So
Booz Allen is a storied, powerful, professional, quality organization. That Snowden got through, was able to do what he did, and didn't even get caught by Booz Allen before the government caught him, that's the surprise here. I think we can all look at Booz Allen's history and say, you know, they've been pretty stand-up, but margin for error, yada, yada, yada. I think they'll be able to lean on that history. This is not an Arthur Andersen kind of situation where they'll have to shut down, but they will definitely have to pivot.
Or change your name.
This is a situation where they will have to show unequivocally that they have new processes in place, that they're working directly with the government to make sure this doesn't happen again, and that they're not, you know, they were not complicit, which I don't think anyone thinks that Booz Allen was really complicit in this.
In new NSA news that came out this week, New York Times reports that they're searching the contents of vast amounts of Americans' email and text communications into and out of the country, hunting for people who mention information about foreigners under surveillance, according to intelligence officials. Essentially, the NSA temporarily copies and then sifts through the contents of what is apparently most emails and other text-based communications that cross the border, according to senior intelligence officials. And then they search the data for identifying keywords or other selectors and stores those that match so that human analysts could later examine them. So essentially, if you're sending an email or text message to someone outside of the country, it's a foregone conclusion that the NSA is capturing that for later sifting.
Yeah. How deep they sift is the question, really. It sounds like they just sift because it went out of the country. Oh, it's not really about anyone that we're looking for. Okay, let's move on to the next guy. But still, you know, your communications, if you're sending them overseas, are getting some level of early monitoring.
Yeah. And The Guardian reported also that the NSA has a secret backdoor into its vast databases, under a legal authority enabling it to search for U.S. citizens' emails and phone calls without a warrant, according to a document passed to The Guardian by Edward Snowden. The authority, approved in 2011, appears to contrast with repeated assurances from Barack Obama and senior intelligence officials that the privacy of U.S. citizens is protected from the NSA's Dragnet surveillance program.
Yeah, I think that as we hear more out of Edward Snowden and that it's verified as like actual documents, I think that any controversy over whether or not Snowden is a true is either, you know, is some kind of kid who just wanted to like get some 15 minutes of fame, or if there really are abuses here, you know, like if you were him and you want to like roll this stuff out, you roll it out slowly over time to get the most momentum. And I think we are going to see some things that, frankly, many of us are not going to be comfortable with. And as much as I think that the process that he used to drop this stuff out is one that needs to be questioned, we do have to question the actual material. And speaking of Snowden today, Ed, Bradley Manning, the private first class worked with WikiLeaks to roll out some information about the government, particularly the way diplomats were speaking about people and so on and so forth. He was sentenced today, and he during his hearing, he said that he was sorry. Just another whistleblower who you know decided to go this kind of covert route and got caught. So it's interesting to see how Snowden's going to navigate the next several months and years, and how history will look at him based on, you know, what happens to these other people like Manning and so on.
It is interesting. I remember some of the I think, Dwayne, you had brought up the Pentagon Papers earlier in context to these leaks, and how the how history has sort of judged those whistleblowers as heroes, you know, 30, 40 years on. It does make me wonder how history will judge Manning, the Mannings and the Snowdens of today, 30, 40 years on from now.
Right. I mean, you look at the Watergate, and it's clear that there was illegal wrongdoing by the government, the president, and so on. The president was working outside of the government, outside of law. But it gets trickier with what we're looking at now, because there were laws in place passed by congressmen who swore secrecy. They wouldn't tell us that these laws were in place.
Yeah.
That allow courts like the FISA court to kind of do the kind of stuff that makes us all, frankly, very uncomfortable. So it's a far more complicated issue in a far more complicated world.
I think President Obama is feeling the heat, and he's particularly sensitive to the concerns that Americans are having about this. He last week he hosted a meeting with Apple CEO Tim Cook, AT&T CEO Randall Stephenson, and Vince Cerf, who many people call the father of the internet, and other tech executives and civil liberties leaders on Thursday, last Thursday, for a closed door meeting about government surveillance. We probably will never know what the content of that meeting is, but it's interesting that he is trying to get feedback from those important people, as well as he had a conference recently, a press conference, where he talked about you know, the scrutiny of NSA's programs. He's trying to justify a more detailed legal justification for domestic spying. He says it's right to ask questions about surveillance, particularly as technology is reshaping every aspect of our lives. It's not enough for me as president to have confidence in these programs. The American people need to have confidence in them as well. He said, if you're the ordinary person and you start seeing a bunch of headlines saying U.S. Big Brother looking down on you, collecting telephone records, etc., well, understandably, people would be concerned. To others around the world, I want to make clear once again that America is not interested in spying on ordinary people. Our intelligence is focused above all in finding the information that's necessary to protect our people, in many cases, protect our allies. I don't know. I just don't know how. I understand his point of view, his side of the story, in this effort to rebuild public trust. I just don't know how you know, it's going to take a long, it's going to be a long road to hoe to rebuild the trust, that trust up again.
Yeah, it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy. I mean, this is, it's bigger than Obama. I mean, these things were put in place before Barack Obama became president. Yeah. When you walk in as president and you realize that there hasn't been an attack in however many, in nearly a decade, you know, 2001 was the attack and there wasn't, you're like, how have we been able to pull that off? Clearly, it's not just from stuff that we, that's obvious and out there in the public eye. And when you learn about what's been going on, you have to look at it and you have to say to yourself, okay, what am I going to do? How comfortable am I maintaining these processes which have worked for so long? We're doing so many things, it's hard to tell exactly what's worked. But I can for sure say that getting rid of anything has a very high risk associated with it. So let's see how these things go. I mean, he sat there with AT&T and he's like, hey, man, let's talk about your share everything plan. And I feel like that's kind of what you have to do, right? Yeah. He's got a legacy to protect. He's got to sit there. He's got to think about, well, yes, people might hate me later because this impingement on their freedoms. But if there's a bomb that blows up, like what happened in Boston, and we didn't catch it, and it's bigger than that, then where's my legacy then? Where's, you know, and how many people have died? Yada, yada, yada. So...
yeah, it's more than just words, it's action, right? So that's what it's going to really boil down to. And we'll see what happens. We'll see if anything happens.
I know. I was talking to Barack Obama the other day, and he's like, I was like, dude, my mom says that you're totally surveilling everybody. He goes, dude, she's not your mom.
All right. With that, we're going to take one last break. But when we come back, every major Bitcoin player gets subpoenaed, but that's not necessarily bad news. So take a listen to this and come on back.
Now, who's hot, who not? Tell me who rock, who sell out in the stores? You tell me who flop, who cop the blue drop? Who jewels got box, who mostly Dolce down to the blue drop? The same old pimp, Mace, you know ain't nothing changed but my limp. Can't stop till I see my name on a blimp. Guarantee me and shells pull a level up. You don't believe in Harlem World, nigga, double up. We don't play around, it's a bet, lay it down. Niggas didn't know me 91, bet they know me now. I'm the young Harlem nigga with the Goldie sound. Can't no PD, niggas hold me down. Cooler, school me to the game, now I know my duty. Stay humble, stay low, blow like Hootie. True pimp, nigga, spend no dough on the booty. When you yell, there go Mace, there go your cutie.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Cersini, and I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafuaken. Things are getting serious for Bitcoin this month. A federal judge declared it real money, Bloomberg gave it an experimental ticker, and the New York State Department of Financial Services is declaring Bitcoin a virtual Wild West for narco-traffickers and other criminals, subpoenaing 22 digital currency companies and investors to get a lay of the Bitcoin land. They sent letters to the major Bitcoin players asking them to hand over information regarding their money laundering controls, consumer protection practices, sources of fundings, pitch books, and investment strategies. The recipients of the subpoenas are nationwide and include everyone on the people making real money on Bitcoin list, such as Bitcoin exchanges and processors, mining equipment makers, and major investors such as the Winklevosses, Mark Andreessen, and Ben Horowitz, and Google's venture fund. Now, just to be clear, subpoena doesn't mean that criminal activity has taken place. A person familiar with the matter says the department wants to make sure Bitcoin isn't a conduit for illicit activities and gathering information in order to decide whether to issue regulation for virtual currencies. The good news about this is that In addition to rooting out illegal activity, the department says it wants to make sure Bitcoin companies' customers' funds are safe and sound, expressing concern about consumer complaints about how quickly virtual currency transactions are processed. So essentially, they're prepping Bitcoin to be a legitimate, accepted currency.
I don't know if they're prepping it. They're basically saying, we need to take a look at your controls, companies that are using this, to understand how money is flowing, how this new version of money is working in the monetary system, and to make sure that it's not being used, because it doesn't have the controls that normal money has on it. It's not being used in ways that could counter law enforcement efforts or simple normal regulatory control efforts that occur with normal currencies. The fact that the court said that Bitcoin is in fact a real currency is a coup for Bitcoin. Yeah. And like you said, like you read, the idea that you're getting subpoenaed doesn't mean that you're involved in legal activity. It just means that you know something that people in the government don't and that they would like to know or get your take on it. So this is a big step for Bitcoin, for better or for worse. It could be that everyone that they subpoena, they find out that, man, you guys are all crooks. But it could be that, you know, we're looking at what's the future or a possible future or a new way of dealing with funds that is, you know, getting explored by a government agency that's doing what it's supposed to do and trying to protect its people. If only they had these kinds of subpoena powers and interest back when the financial crisis was beginning to happen.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like maybe I'll be more of the naysayer in this conversation, but to me it feels like, well, let's figure out how we can jump in and get our hands into this new currency in terms of additional positive cash flow.
You mean like government wants tax money kind of thing?
Tax money, all sorts of government intervention that you currently don't have in it. Not necessarily keeping people safe in utilizing it. Because there's a lot of other things that the government could be keeping us safe in terms of like currency. It's just them hopping in at a time that they think prime to. I mean, heck, there's a lot of research they could do without necessarily throwing out subpoenas. You know, I don't know if that's necessarily like it seems strange to me to go to take that angle unless you really want to force your way in.
I think you could be totally right. I look at subpoena power as something that allows the government to move more quickly than the government's going to be doing research, but they're also going to use subpoenas because that's part of their research as well. They have resources that the average individual doesn't have when it comes to determining information. And one of those big resources is being able to say, let me talk to the people that I think are experts in this instead of just going out and reading their papers. How do I know they're experts? I did preliminary research. Now I want to find more. I want to find more quickly so that I don't lose my government job.
You know, typically the way we do this is we schedule calls on the calendar. We don't like toss subpoenas out. I mean,
a subpoena doesn't mean that you have to show up in a courtroom necessarily. It could be, hey, we're subpoenaing you. We're going to send the guy over to take a deposition from you.
Right. Or we want the records. We want boxes of records.
Right. So like there could be a deposition or there can be, hey, we want to see all your documents on XYZ, ABC. Normal companies get subpoenaed all the time from the Federal Trade Commission or other places that are wondering about new business models. I wouldn't be surprised if on Google's books there were a ton of different FTC inquiries or other things like that, only because they broke open new businesses. So I wouldn't be that worried about it now, but it does show this is a big step because the government is interested in how Bitcoin functions as a monetary system. And, you know, obviously that may lead to regulation. I mean, it definitely will lead to regulation. But it also shows that it's maturing. It's not just some super fringe element that is, hey, that's weird, it'll go away in 2 months.
Right. Well, now it makes me wish I had invested in Bitcoin at the time. It may be too late now. Okay, so let's wrap this up with our drill down video of the week. And I thank you, Dwayne, for linking us this video. It's Millennials in the Workplace. It's a short little comedy skit, and anyone who has worked, particularly anyone, I would say over a certain age, who has worked in any workplace with anyone with a segment of society that is under a certain age will relate immediately to this skit, as I did. You want to describe it a little, Dwayne?
Basically, it's the year 2013. Millennials are out of college and they're in the workforce, and they're the new workers coming in. And this is just an instructional video in terms of how to deal with them properly. And there's a lot of really good advice here. Andy calls it a skit. I call it just straight up education. I put this up there with NPR, Planet Money, whatever. So if I were you, I'd get online, check out the Geeks of Doom, the drill down, and take a look at this video, because it can really help you determine the best way to move forward and get the most out of the millennials in your workplace, because they're only growing.
Right. Like a disease. No, just kidding. And kind of not. All right. All right. Let's go around the table here, and I'm going to start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on the drill down?
You can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/DwayneD, DWAYNED. You can also find me at flavors.me/DwayneD, where most of my stuff is linked. And, you know, when I'm not there, you guys can find me here on the drill down.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
So you can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, ircwebcast.blogspot.com. If you make your way up to PAX in a couple of weeks in Seattle, you'll catch me there. I've got a panel on Monday.
Cool.
So you can catch me there, as well as you can always catch me on this show.
I'm sorry, what's the panel about again?
This is... it's a Paxing prank panel. It's Lando's and Potatoes Collide.
Nice. All right. As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com or Twitter.com and Facebook.com at MrBabyMan. If you've got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about here on The Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you've got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. So far, we published a lot of stories from people submitting stuff, so we want to keep that rolling. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach a targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our amazing audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.